So as I mentioned last time, the antidote to the mess of samsara that we're in is the 37 practices of bodhisattvas. That's what helps us overcome the causes of the unsatisfactory conditions that produce the unsatisfactory conditions. And that's reality. So I'll read them out and just try and go through them. Okay, so it's the 37 practices of bodhisattvas. It's a text by Gyaltse Tongne Zampo, who was a Tibetan monk who lived several centuries ago. And it starts out homage to Lokeshwara. So it means homage to Avalokiteshvara, Chenrezig, the Buddha of compassion. And then the first couple of verses are his paying homage and making an intention to compose the text. So I'll just read those. I pay constant homage through my three doors, that means by body, speech, and mind, to my supreme teacher and protector, Chenrezig, who while seeing all phenomena lack coming and going, means that he sees that all phenomena lack inherent existence, makes single-minded effort for the good of sentient beings, meaning that the teacher Chenrezig has compassion and bodhicitta. Okay, so those are the two principal wings of the path, the wisdom and method side. Perfect Buddhas, source of all well-being and happiness, arise from accomplishing the excellent teachings. And this depends on knowing the practices, so I will explain the practices of bodhisattvas. Okay. A Buddha is somebody who's completely eliminated all defilements from the mind and developed all of the good qualities limitlessly. So that's the potential, what we have to become, the final goal, the final aim. Bodhisattvas are those who are intent on Buddhahood, who have that strong motivation to attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all living beings. And so they're often called the children of the Buddha, or the Buddha's offsprings, or the sons and daughters of the Buddha, because they want to grow up spiritually to be like the Buddha. Okay, so Tongme Sampo is going to explain how these bodhisattvas practice to be able to become Buddhas. Okay, so the first verse. Having gained this rare ship of freedom and fortune, hear, think, and meditate unwaveringly night and day in order to free yourself and others from the ocean of cyclic existence. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. Okay, so this verse talks about precious human life. That's what's meant by the rare ship of freedom and fortune. And so our current lives are free in the sense that we are free from being born in realms of great suffering or realms of too much happiness. Okay, if we're born in realms of great suffering, the hellish realm, the hungry ghost realm, the animal realm, then the mind is too distracted by either being spaced out with ignorance or by physical suffering to be able to do spiritual practice. If we're born in the upper realms, some of the god realms, where they have, you know, incredible either sense pleasure or mental pleasure, then we're too distracted by the pleasure to actually focus on freeing ourselves, on practicing the path. So a human life has exactly the right combination of suffering and happiness, you know, in terms of if you've got to be born in samsara, it's a good rebirth because it has this right combination of a good enough situation so that we're not constantly overwhelmed by pain and enough suffering to remind us that we're not liberated yet, so we need to make effort. Okay, so we should cherish this opportunity that we have because it's rare to have a precious human life. You know, you have to create a lot of causes for it in terms of keeping ethical discipline and being generous and so on and so forth. So it's hard to create the causes, hard to get the result. And even when we look around numerically, how many living beings on this planet have a precious human life? I'm just human beings in general compared to animals and insects. We're highly outnumbered. Okay, and everybody who has a human life doesn't have a precious human life Because to have a precious human life, you have to have met the teachings and have interest in them, have the, you know, the mental and physical ability to be able to practice them. So just being born human itself isn't enough. So it's quite rare, you know, numerically to have a precious human life where we have, you know, we have mental clarity, we have physical health, we have access to teachers and to teachings and to a Sangha community, a monastic community around us, to live in a place where there's religious freedom, where we can practice. So, you know, it's quite extraordinary, this present opportunity we have, that if we're not interested in spiritual practice, we don't tend to recognize our incredible opportunity, and instead we spend our time complaining about the conditions of our life. Okay, but if we're interested in spiritual practice, then we see how incredibly fortunate our life is, and we find there's not much to complain about at all. Okay, so this, you know, if you're interested in spiritual practice, if you do this meditation, it brings your heart a lot of joy, and it makes you not have anything to complain about, because you realize you have all the freedom and fortune in the world to do what is most important, which is to do your Dharma practice in order to free yourself and others. Okay, how do you free yourself and others? By hearing, thinking, and meditating. Okay, so the you hear these three steps a lot. First, we have to hear, and hear means not just hearing with our ear, but it means learning. Okay, so we have to hear teachings orally, we have to study them, we have to learn the teachings. I think hearing is mentioned here specifically because, you know, in previous times books were rather rare, and so you had to hear the teachings orally. But I also think that you get something special when you hear the teachings that you don't get when you read them. Okay? What do you get? You get the oral transmission. You get the teaching from somebody who practices it, who's telling you in, you know, live happening what, you know, how to practice. And that's different than listening to a tape in your home. Or it's different than reading a book. Okay? Because if you read a book, you know, a book gives you the information. A book can be very inspiring. And once you've heard the teachings orally, if you read a book, it works well. But if all you do is read and study through transcripts and manuscripts and something, but you never have the oral teachings, your practice is really lacking. You know, and I've just found this by personal experience, that the example of having a real live human being there teaching me, who also, you know, corrects my faults and, you know, points out, can give personal advice and do things like that, and shows an example of how to live the teaching. So that's been quite practical. You know, precious. A book doesn't show you how to live the teachings in day-to-day life. A teacher who you watch how they act in their day-to-day life, how they relate to happenings around them, gives you that example. Okay, so I think hearing the teachings live is also very precious. And in this day of, you know, of internet, yes, it's very valuable to have access to teachings online. And I would say that that's a step up from simply reading a book. Okay, and by the way, I'm not putting down reading books, because books are very important, okay? But, okay, hearing the teachings orally is also important. But the thing that happens, why do you need to leave the comfort of your own house and go somewhere to hear teachings? You know, that you can't just sit and listen to a tape in your house, or listen to the tape as you drive to work, or listen to the tape while you're leaning back in your easy chair. Why not? You know, what do you get out of being at a teaching live that you don't get out of listening to a tape?
What is the effort you make to be there?
Exactly. The effort that you make to be there. And that makes a big difference. Okay? Because when we have to put in effort to be somewhere, we pay more attention. We cherish it more. OK, Okay. You come here to listen to teachings, you have to sit up straight. Okay? You're not lying in your bed drinking a cup of tea, relaxing. You have to just even put some effort to sit up straight, you know, without even something to lean against sometimes, you know? And you have to put in efforts to drive here. Okay? And you sit in a room with other people, which reminds you that you're connected to other living beings. You're not sitting there with headphones on in your own little world. Okay, you're with other people practicing. That makes a big difference. Okay, and you're able to pay attention because you're not having to look for the red lights. Okay, and you're not having to look at your odometer. So hearing teachings, you know, live instead of when you're driving in your car, you listen in a very different way. And I think that's quite important because people, you know, nowadays we want everything just very easy, very simple. You know, I want to lie in bed and get enlightened. Yeah? Why can't I just lie in bed and listen to the teachings with my earphones and drink a cup of tea and, you know, watch the television at the same time? Well, exactly that, because you're doing all of it. Yeah? So, but having to make the effort to come and, you know, and then to listen in a group makes a big difference. And sitting up straight and paying attention and the whole atmosphere, what you're doing in between sessions when you're here, how you eat lunch, how do you go to sleep, how you offer service, all of those non-session activities that we do at the Abbey influence how you take in the teachings. Okay? So the hearing is very important. Okay, then on top of hearing, we have to think. So we're not enlightened by hearing, okay, or by learning. We have to think about the teachings. So we have to put in energy to think about them and make sure we understand them correctly. So thinking here doesn't just mean thinking ourselves. It also means discussing with other people. Because sometimes if we just think about the teachings ourselves, we may think that we understand them, but it's only when somebody asks us a question that we realize we're clueless. Okay? And so it's important to discuss the teachings with other people and hear their questions and hear their interpretations of the teachings so that we can really check up and think more deeply and get a more comprehensive understanding of the teachings. But thinking and discussing the teachings alone doesn't, you know, it has a strong impact on our mind, but it doesn't bring the realizations. We also need to meditate, and we need to put the teachings into practice in our daily life. Okay? So it's good to have a regular, consistent daily practice that we do where we actually meditate on the teachings and think about them more in depth and apply them to our life and, you know, really try and understand them and integrate them with our own mind stream. Okay. It's good to do these three things in order, hearing, thinking, and meditating, because in order to meditate, you have to have a correct conceptual understanding of the teaching. You gain that by thinking. In order to think about the teachings, you have to learn them, and you get that by hearing. So we start out by learning, hearing, then thinking, then meditating. That doesn't mean that at the beginning all you do is hear and or study and you don't think and you don't meditate. Okay, it doesn't mean that. Yeah, we should try and do all three. But on any particular topic, we have to first learn the topic before we can think about it, before we can meditate and integrate it. And I think this is quite important because lots of people think meditating, you just sit with your eyes closed, and that's meditating. That's not meditating, okay? That's what you do with your body. But what you do with your mind is what meditating is. Okay, and you can sit with your eyes closed and daydream about, you know, Prince Charming. That's not meditating. Okay, so we have to learn exactly what meditation is and how to do it. Now, if we make up our own style of meditation, then we get the results of making up our own style of meditation. And if we learn how the Buddha, the enlightened being, meditated, then, and we follow those instructions, then we get the results of meditating on, you know, in a method taught by somebody who actually got results. Okay, so there's a big difference between making up our own style of meditation, where we don't have a clue what we're doing, and following a method that's been tried and true for 2,600 years. Okay, so, you know, to meditate, then we have to think, and then we have to learn. And that's quite important. Yeah. I mean, I get emails from people, I listen to music when I meditate. What kind of music should I listen to when I meditate? Well, it's clear this person has never listened to teachings, because you don't listen to music and meditate at the same time. Okay? Because if you listen to music, you're listening to music, and you're not thinking about the teachings and integrating them. Okay? So, you know, that's why it's so important to actually get teachings and to know what it means to meditate. Okay? So this verse is saying, you know, having gained this rare ship of freedom and fortune, hear, think, and meditate unwaveringly night and day. Okay, you can sleep a little bit, but you can, before you go to sleep, you, instead of collapsing in bed, you think, I'm going to sleep so I can rest my body and mind so I can continue practicing tomorrow. Okay, why do you do all this? In order to free yourself and others from the ocean of cyclic existence. So your underlying motivation is a motivation of bodhicitta, attaining full enlightenment in order to liberate ourselves and others from cyclic existence. Then, verse 2, attached to your loved ones, you're stirred up like water. Hating your enemies, you burn like fire. In the darkness of confusion, you forget what to adopt and discard. Give up your homeland. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. This is a very powerful verse, okay? Attached to your loved ones, you're stirred up like water. Is that true or not true? You know, when you're attached to people and you're clinging to them, and I love you so much I can't be separated from you, is your mind peaceful? No, you're stirred up like water. You have what we were talking about last session, worry, fear over what's going to happen to them, wanting to save them. Okay, our mind's not peaceful because the mind is overpowered with attachment. Attachment's very different from love. Okay, they're similar in the sense that both of them are drawn toward, make us drawn toward the other person. But when we're attached, we're drawn because that person meets our needs, and there's a lot of strings attached. You know, I love you. Love in quotes, as long as you do this and that and this. Okay, I love you because you're mine. You're my child or my spouse or my parents or my friend. Okay, whereas in the love we're trying to generate by practicing the path, we want to learn to love, to want others to have happiness and the causes of happiness, but without having the strings attached, because the strings make us like a yo-yo and we're stirred up like water. You know, here and there and this and that. And what do they think of me? And do they love me? And have I offended them? And how can I get in their good graces? And how can I become what I think they want me to be so that they'll love me even more? It's not very peaceful, is it? Okay, so attached to our loved ones, we're stirred up like water. Hating your enemies, you burn like fire. True or not true? True. Okay. Enemies doesn't mean Saddam Hussein. Enemies means anybody that we don't like. Okay. And, you know, it could be the guy that cuts you off when you're driving on the highway. It could be the colleague that you're jealous of because they got the promotion and you didn't. It could be your next door neighbor who lied to you. It could be, you know, the thief who stole your stuff, or the person who scratched your car. It could be your kid who took the battery out of your car when you had to go to work. You know, whoever we happen to be upset with at that moment becomes our enemy. Okay? Now, with our enemies, we burn like fire, don't we? You know, we're burning with anger. And then we either take it out on them, or we take it out on ourselves. So we either explode or we implode. Again, not a state of mental health. In the darkness of confusion, you forget what to adopt and discard. Okay? So adopt and discard, this means what to practice on the path to enlightenment and what to abandon on the path to enlightenment. When we're confused, yeah, when we're spaced out, when we're intoxicating ourselves with television and media so we can't think straight, then we forget what are the causes of happiness that we need to adopt and practice. And what are the causes of suffering that we need to abandon and discard? And we aren't able to discriminate those things very well. Okay, so we begin thinking that drinking and drugging is, you know, brings happiness. And we begin to think that getting up early in the morning and meditating brings suffering. Okay, so we get quite confused in the darkness of confusion. We can't discriminate what to adopt and discard. Okay? So here, these three lines, the first line is attachment, the second line is explaining anger, the third line is explaining confusion. When we talk about the three poisonous attitudes, these are those three. Okay? Attachment, hostility, or anger, and confusion, or ignorance. Okay? Then, the punchline of this verse, give up your homeland. This is the attack. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. Okay? What does give up your homeland mean? Do we all become expats and move to India? It's not a bad idea. But in India we have visa problems, we have health problems. You know, there's different challenges there. Okay? Give up our homeland means get ourselves out of the situation in which everything and everyone is so familiar to us that we keep on acting out our habitual patterns again and again. For example, and I'm not saying abandon your family here, okay? I'm just talking about an example. You know how sometimes you go to family dinners and there's almost a script that everybody in the family plays out? Okay? You know, there you arrive with your parents, the kids, and, you know, mom says this, and dad says this, and your sister says this, and your brother says this, and lo and behold, you say this just like you did when you were 5 years old, you know, because the situation is so familiar, you've played a certain role for so many years that you just keep playing that role because it's familiar and because everybody else is playing the role, okay? So every family dynamic is a little bit different, but you know, often this is what we get into when we know people too well, is we just play out the same thing. Okay? Dad is always asking you, when are you going to figure out what you want to do with your life and get a good high-paying job? Okay? Mom is always asking you, you know, when you're going to get married and have a family. You know, or if you're already married, when you're going to have kids. Okay, or if you have kids, why don't you raise your kids this way? Okay, your sister is always, you know, competing with you. Your brother is always playing the jokester, you know? And, you know, you just get into the same old thing again and again that you did when you were kids and now you're doing it when you're adults. Okay, the meaning of give up your homeland is give up these situations. Okay. So that doesn't mean you don't go to family dinners. Okay? It means when you're at a family dinner, you don't play your role. You be the grown-up that you are. Okay? And you be a wise grown-up. Yeah? And if you don't play your role, then the other people can't play theirs either. Yeah? When Dad asks you, like he does every year, you know, when are you going to get a high-paying job? You just, you know, and he says, aren't you, you know, isn't it time that you, you know, figured out what you're going to do with your life? Well, yeah, maybe it is, Dad. What can you say? Yeah, maybe it is. That's it. You know, I'm doing the best I can. You know, or... You know, I mean, you don't get into that defensive thing of, well, I am figuring out the meaning of my life, and I am figuring out what I'm doing, and I have been working, and this is, you know, look at how much money I've made. See, I am worthwhile, Dad, after all, even though I wasn't everything you wanted me to be. Okay? So you just give up that whole trip. You give up the defensiveness. So, you know, when you're practicing as a lay person, this is what you want to do, is, you know, pull yourself out of mentally reenacting old roles. And not just with your family, but, you know, we reenact all of our authority issues with our boss, with our Dharma teacher, with whoever we see as in a position of authority. So pull ourselves out of, you know, mentally just conforming to those same old roles. If you choose a monastic way of life, then you really want to leave the old, physically leave the old situation that you were living in, because you realize how difficult it is to change while you're still living in it. Okay? But people are going to choose how they want to practice and what level of practice that they want to have. Okay? And so, this is not a prescription for, you know, everybody moving out of their house tomorrow, okay? It's talking more about, you know, moving out of the preconception, the homeland of our mind, of, you know, all the preconceptions and habits that we live out. But it's powerful, you know, give up our homeland. It's a call for us to change, yeah? Whether you do it as a lay person or whether you do it as a monastic. Okay? The reason that the Abbey exists is so that people who want to live a monastic life can leave their homeland and come live here. Okay? Because, you know, living in a monastic situation gives you a way to practice that you don't have when you live in the city, you know, and in a very busy workaday life. Okay? So just to see, there's different ways to practice, and leaving your homeland has different meanings. And, and so you understand also the role of Shravasti Abbey and what this phrase means. Verse 3, by avoiding bad objects, disturbing emotions gradually decrease. Without distraction, virtuous activities naturally increase. With clarity of mind, conviction in the teaching arises. Cultivate seclusion. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. Okay, so by avoiding bad objects, disturbing emotions gradually decrease. So disturbing emotions like attachment, anger, hostility, resentment, grudge holding. Okay? All of these things gradually subside when you aren't constantly surrounded by the objects that provoke them. So when it says bad objects, it doesn't mean that the objects are bad from their side. It simply means that because our mind is so reactive, when we're in the proximity of certain objects or people, our old habits come up so strong. Okay? So it's not the fault of the object. Bad objects doesn't mean the objects are bad. It means our mind gets uncontrolled when we're near those objects. Okay? And that's very important to understand so that we don't blame the objects or the people that we're reactive toward. Okay? We can't say, you made me angry, you're a bad object, I'm moving out. Okay? You don't make me angry, I make myself angry. Okay, but I know my anger is so strong, and every time I'm in proximity to you, my mind goes bananas, so I need to live in a different kind of situation. Okay, or I have so much attachment that every time I'm near, you know, someone or something, my mind goes crazy, you know, and I can't think clearly, then I need to have some distance from those things that bring up really strong attachment. So the purpose isn't that you just avoid the yay objects so your mind calms down and that's it, but you avoid the things that provoke your mind so that you can have more time to hear, think, and meditate and get rid of the bad habits in the mind that make us so reactive to these people and objects, so that later you can go back into the situation and be more even. But, at the beginning and for a long while, our minds are totally out of control. And so we need a secluded environment. Seclusion doesn't mean you go living in a cave. It means living in an environment where we aren't exposed to all the things that push our buttons, so that we then have the time and space to cultivate the antidotes to our buttons. Okay, so seclusion can refer to the environment. The real seclusion is mental seclusion, when our mind is secluded, you know, meaning it's not reactive to those things. Okay, so it's like if you're attached to ice cream, and you know it's bad for your health, and you know, you don't feel good about yourself when you eat it, you don't go to an ice cream parlor to meet your friends. Okay? It doesn't mean that ice cream is bad. It doesn't mean the ice cream parlor is bad. It just means our mind is uncontrolled. So we stay away from the things that our mind gets uncontrolled about. Okay? So that's the meaning of seclusion. Okay? So if we avoid the objects that incite our ignorance, anger, attachment, resentment, laziness, okay, our disturbing emotions will gradually decrease. Why? Because they aren't provoked, and because we are now actively, you know, hearing, thinking, and meditating to become familiar with the antidotes to those disturbing emotions. Okay? Without distraction, virtuous activities naturally increase. So when we stop living such a busy life, running around here and there doing that, we aren't doing this and that, we aren't so distracted, so naturally it becomes easier to focus on the Dharma. You know? And this is the value of, you know, coming here. Okay? It's the difference between going to Dharma class every 2 weeks and coming here for one day. Going to Dharma class every few weeks or every week or whatever is very beneficial. Okay, when you come here for a whole day, it's much more intense and it's much more concentrated and you're less distracted. Okay, because you don't have your cell phone here. You don't have your email here. There's no television. You know, you're in silence, so you're not busy telling everybody what you like and you dislike and, you know, what all your problems are. Yeah, and so you have time to think. There's a beautiful environment with not a whole lot in it. Yeah, so you're not looking at art books and you're not looking at advertisements and you're not looking at all these other things that in our life distract us. Okay, so, but when you simplify your life, then, and you simplify your environment, then there's less distraction, then virtuous activities naturally increase. Okay? So you come here once in a while, that helps you. Also, when you're at home, you simplify your environment. You know? Get rid of the television. Why do you need a TV at home? Yeah? Stop reading all the pop-up ads on the computer. Stop reading all the catalogs that you get. Put them in the recycling. Yeah? Don't turn on the radio every time you get in the car. Listen to a Dharma tape instead. Okay? Or say mantra. Okay? So simplify our life, you know? Simplify your social life. You don't really need to go here and there and do this and that. Okay. Simplify your hobbies. Choose a few things that you enjoy doing instead of trying to do everything and be everything because you think that's what you have to be and do so that people will love you. You know, do what is really important to you and simplify. I mean, question that concept that says everybody has to love me, so I have to run around and doing all these things so that they'll all love me. You know, is that true? Okay, so simplify. And I think that's important. And this fits in, you know, a lot of people ask, you know, is Buddhism applicable to social issues? You bet. Look at consumerism, you know. Simplify your life. Ask yourself why you drive all the places you drive to. You know, carpool with people. Maybe don't go so many places. Maybe structure your life so you do all your errands at one time so you waste less gas and you also waste less time and you're not so distracted. Don't buy so much because then you don't have so much to take care of. Okay? There's a new book called Hooked. And it talks about Buddhist, you know, reflections on consumerism, you know. And I think that there's a lot here for us to think about in our spiritual practice. Okay? With clarity of mind, conviction in the teachings arises. Okay? So when we have less distraction, when we're not around the things that incite our disturbing attitudes and negative motivations, then we have more clarity of mind, so we can learn, think, and meditate on the teachings. And obviously from that, conviction arises, okay, because our mind is more immersed in the teachings. The people who did the 3-month Vajrasattva retreat, they really see that. You know, they come here for 3 months, and they're living in a different environment, and they're doing six sessions of meditation a day. And they all said to me, wow, I had time to think about the Dharma. You know, I've heard so many teachings, but I never really sat down and thought about them a whole lot. You know, because you're too busy, you know, running around doing this and that. Okay, then for 3 months, there wasn't, you know, you either thought about the Dharma or you thought about what the cats are doing. You know? Or you thought about the weather. You know, or you thought about, you know, why the person sitting next to you breathes so loud. But, you know, eventually you start thinking about Vajrasattva and you start thinking about the Dharma. And so some conviction in the teaching arises because you've had the time to actually think, you know, and you have a clear mind because you aren't doing so much stuff, you know, because you... You know, you meditate and you eat, and then you meditate and you do some yoga, and then you meditate and you have lunch, and then you meditate and do some gardening, and then you meditate and do some more yoga, and then you meditate again, and then you go to sleep, and that's your day. You know, you do some chores, you offer service in the community, and it's a simple lifestyle, okay? So conviction comes. So when it talks about, when we say the verse, cultivate seclusion, it means a secluded and a simplified environment, which you can also do at home. And it means a mind that's secluded from ignorance, anger, and attachment. Okay? So that's what it says. By avoiding bad objects, disturbing emotions gradually decrease. Without distraction, virtuous activities naturally increase. With clarity of mind, conviction, and the teaching arises. Cultivate seclusion. This is the practice of Bodhisattva. Okay? Next verse. Loved ones who have long kept company will part. Wealth created with difficulty will be left behind. Consciousness, the guest, will leave the guest house of the body. Let go of this life. This is the practice of Bodhisattva. So, loved ones who have long kept company will part. Very often, we think one purpose of our life is to have a lot of loved ones, you know, and that we need people around us who love us. And so we do a lot of things to get the love that we need. But at the end of the day, we part from our loved ones, don't we? Yeah? anything that comes together has to part. So, you know, at the end of the day, either you die or they die, or you part from in some other means. So realizing this, that we can't stay with our loved ones forever, actually helps us have a better relationship with them while we are with them, because it makes us less attached, and we also take them less, we don't take them for granted as much. Okay? We don't see them as a projection of ourself and then just dump all of our frustration and anger out on them. So when we see that, you know, we're going to part from our loved ones, it helps us not to get attached, and that helps us to have a stronger Dharma practice. And it helps us, when we are with our loved ones, to actually have a better relationship with them. Okay? Wealth created with difficulty will be left behind. So all, you know, we're working in order to buy the clothes and get the car to go to work, to earn the money to pay the bills, to get the car and clothes to go to work, you know. So the wealth that we gather with great effort comes, goes, doesn't it? You know, and we never have enough money to feel totally secure. And at the time we die, we separate from all the money we've earned. Okay? So recognizing that we never have enough to feel totally secure, and that at the time of death we separate from it, then we stop being so attached to our wealth. We stop being so obsessed with our wealth. We aren't attached to presenting the image of somebody who's well-to-do and successful in a worldly way. We become content with how much we have. And I think contentment is the real wealth. Because if you don't have contentment, you can have $1 million and be very unhappy. If you're content, you can have $10 and be quite happy. Okay? Consciousness. The guest will leave the guest house of this body. So consciousness, our mind, that is currently residing in the guest house of this body, okay, is someday going to move out. Our mind is not always going to be in this body. Our mind is going to move on to the next life. So the whole ego identity we constructed for ourselves based on this body, based on the society and social influence we find ourselves living in, all that's going to happen when our consciousness moves out of this body. Okay? So the whole identity of, you know, I am this nationality, I am this religion, I am this socioeconomic class, I am this educational status, I have, you know, these interests, I am this racial group, I am this ethnic group, I am this gender, I am this, sexual orientation. I like these hobbies. I don't like these kinds of people. This is my political views. The whole ego identity that we've built up so that we think we know who we are stops at the time of death. Consciousness moves out of this body, and so that whole thing crumbles. Okay? So an awareness of this makes us ask ourselves what is important in life. So, loved ones who have long kept company will part. So, what is important in life? Is it important to be attached to loved ones and to go through all the things we try and do to make people love us? Or is it more important to have relationships with people without clinging attachment and further our spiritual practice? Okay, wealth created with difficulty will be left behind. Okay, so what's important in our life? Is it to work overtime and, you know, have tons of money and then have it all evaporate when we die? Or is it more important to spend time doing other things in our life and make enough money to keep ourselves alive, but be content with some simplicity? We don't need a lot. Okay? Consciousness will leave the guest house of this body. You know, do I have to keep running around trying to make my mind happy all the time? Or what is important to do with my mind? Okay, and we really come here to the conclusion that our Dharma practice is very important, because at the time we die, our wealth stays behind, our body stays behind, our friends and relatives stay behind. What comes with us is all the habits that we've developed throughout our life. Okay, so they can be habits of ignorance, hostility, and attachment, or they can be habits of kindness, consideration, generosity, ethical discipline, and wisdom. Okay, so what kind of habits are we going to cultivate? What kind of karma are we going to create? Okay, because that's what's going to come with us. So when it says let go of this life, it means let go of attachment to this life. Okay, put focus on what's important to do, considering that our life is not going to go on forever, and we actually don't even know when it's going to end. Okay? We all have this idea of, you know, we're going to die sometime in the future when we're 1,000 years old. Correct or not correct? Or we have no idea when we're going to die, do we? And we need to be prepared to die at any moment. Are we prepared? And what does being prepared to die mean? Does it mean you have your burial plot all lined up? Well, when you're dead, you're not going to care beans about what they do with your body. Okay, so, I mean, preparing for death doesn't mean having your burial plot. You know, it means, what are you going to do with your mind when you're dying? Okay, so if we let go of this life and all that attachment and focus on what's important, we will have much more peace of mind this life. We'll be able to die without regrets and without fear. And then our next rebirth will be quite smooth, you know, and we'll be able to continue to practice the path so that we can progress along the path to liberation and enlightenment. Verse 5, when you keep their company, your three poisons increase. Your activities of hearing, thinking, and meditating decline. And they make you lose your love and compassion. Give up bad friends. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. Okay. So again, when they say bad friends, it doesn't mean the other person is bad. Okay? What it means is that our mind gets uncontrolled around the other person. Or it means that the other person has values that are not Dharma values. And when we hang around them, we come under the influence of their values. Okay? You know how you tell your kids don't hang around other kids who take drugs and who drink? Yeah, why do you tell your kids that? Because you know if they stay around people who do that, they're going to start doing it. Okay, now the big question comes, why do you hang around with people who drink and drug? You know, you say one thing to your kids and you do another thing yourself. I shouldn't ask questions like that. People don't like it. But it's true. Okay. So, you know, when we hang around people who drink and drug, we start drinking and drugging. We lose our mindfulness and awareness. We start doing all sorts of negative actions. Okay. If you hang around people whose value is making as much money, even if it's doing slightly shady or slightly deceptive activities, then that's what you're going to start to do, and you're going to get drawn into their kind of shady business deals and different things like that. If you hang around people who are always keeping themselves the busiest of the busy, then you're going to become the busiest of the busy. Okay? So the whole idea here is, you know, when you keep their company, your three poisons increase. Okay? Again, not because the people are bad, but because our mind gets uncontrolled. And because they may have values that are not really conducive to human happiness, and we come under the influence of their values. So making good friends is incredibly important on the path. You know? And it's really important because You know, I think our spiritual heart is the most important part of ourself. And if you meet with people who value that, then they're going to nurture that part in you. If you meet people who aren't spiritual at all, and those are your best friends, then they're going to nurture another tendency in you. So what seeds in yourself do you want other people to water, and what people are going to water with seeds? So that's what this verse and the next verse are actually about. So it's important to have Dharma friends. When you have Dharma friends and you say to them, I'm going to go do a retreat, they say, great, tell me about it, I want to come with you. If you tell your worldly friends, I'm going to go do a retreat, they say, what in the world are you doing? You're going to go sit on a cushion for a whole weekend? Get a life, you know, do something interesting. Yeah, and those people will discourage your Dharma practice. And then you start having doubts. Oh, yeah, you know, I'm going there to sit on a cushion. Why should I do that? You know, my mind's just distracted. My knees hurt. Yeah, better I should go and lie on the beach with this friend. Yeah, my knees don't hurt there. Okay? So when you keep their company, your three poisons increase. Your activities of hearing, thinking, and meditating decline because your friends don't support those activities. They want you to go out and play and go to the movies and go to the party and, you know, or stay home and watch TV or whatever it is. They make you lose your love and compassion. Yeah, because instead of being able to meditate on love and compassion, you're always having to justify yourself and explain yourself, and they do things that you don't like, and then you get upset. Okay, so give up bad friends. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. And the next verse, when you rely on them, your faults come to an end, and your good qualities grow like the waxing moon. Cherish spiritual teachers even more than your own body. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. So this is talking about good friends. Actually, the meaning of geshi, literal translation, is a virtuous friend. Okay? So what we want, whether somebody has the title geshi or not, is we want spiritual friends. We want Dharma friends. We want virtuous friends. So the best virtuous friends we can have are our spiritual teachers, because those are the people who know the Dharma the best and who will encourage us in the Dharma. And then, of course, we want to have Dharma friends too. But our spiritual teachers are the ones who actually teach us, and the role they play in our life is vitally important. Because if you think about it, I mean, our parents love us tremendously, but have our parents taught us, or can they teach us, the path to enlightenment? No way. You know, different friends may love us a lot. Can they teach us the path to enlightenment? No. Okay? So the people who are able to teach us how to free our mind and get our mind out of this, you know, situation of cyclic existence, those people are rare and they're very, very precious. So that's why it says, cherish them even more than our own body. And that, I think that has great meaning. And it puts us in the position of asking, how much do we really cherish the Dharma? I don't want to go to listen to teachings because it's too uncomfortable. I'm not going to teachings because I don't feel well. Okay, so again, attachment to our body, the comfort of our body, becomes more important than going to teachings, than cultivating a relationship with our spiritual mentors, because we're so attached to the comfort of our body. When we hang around spiritual teachers, it's true. I mean, our good qualities grow like the waxing moon, because you're around people who keep ethical discipline. You know, they're not lying and swindling people and talking bad about people behind their back and saying harsh words. They're not involved in idle gossip and singing and dancing and playing music and doing all sorts of distracting activities. So when you hang around people like that, then you come to do what they're doing, which is hearing, thinking, and meditating and putting it into practice in your daily life. And so when you do that, of course your virtuous activities increase like the waxing moon. And, you know, when you're around your spiritual mentors, then you have a really good example to follow. People who practice well. You know, and that shows us, it teaches us how to practice. I love being around my teachers. And one of the most difficult things that for me about being in America is not being around my teachers. Okay? It's another reason that the Abbey exists, so that like-minded people can stay together. And so that we can have teachers come here and visit and teach us. But it's very important to have spiritual teachers, to cultivate relationships with them, you know, and to offer service and to hang around them. And I don't mean hang around like sit and chat, you know, and spend 4 hours over lunch. I mean, you know, you live together and you see what it's like, okay? I remember when I was in India, I took a friend of mine to visit one of my spiritual teachers, and he invited us to have dinner. He's the ex-abbot of Sarah J. Monastery, and actually we're hoping he'll be here at the Abbey for some weeks in the winter, in the fall and winter this year. So he invited us for dinner, and one beggar came around during the time we were having dinner, and you know, Kenzo Rinpoche went in the other room and got a blanket and gave it to the beggar. And my friend, who, you know, was like so impressed, like, wow, he gave away one of his blankets to a beggar. And, it, you know, she really started going, would I do that? You know? And then she began to see his qualities and this generosity he has. Now, if she wasn't in that situation of just being there at that time, she never would have seen that. She never would have been inspired by receiving that kind of real-life teaching of seeing how somebody relates in a situation. You know, you benefit from the situation. Also, when you offer service, yeah? I mean, this book that I'm reading, Transforming the Heart, which is going to be republished. Snow Lion is republishing it under the title of Transforming Adversity into Joy and Courage. Okay, so Kenzo Rinpoche, Geshe Denpa Tekchok, he's the author from it. He taught the, you know, he gave the teachings, and then somebody else transcribed them, and then I edited them and made them into a book. So that was my way of offering service to him. It was an incredible way for me to learn the Dharma. Mm-hmm. Okay? Because when you edit your teacher's writings, when you transcribe them, you know, when you're doing this kind of work of offering service, you learn tremendously. You know, there's many ways to, quote, be around your spiritual teacher. Okay? But the thing is, when you rely on them, your faults come to an end. So relying also means attending teachings. Attending retreats. It doesn't mean just being around them, okay? So when you rely on their teachings, okay, your faults come to an end and your good qualities grow like the waxing moon. Cherish spiritual teachers even more than your own body. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. And another meaning why they say even more than your own body, because if you lose your body, the worst that happens is you die. And if you have some good karma, you get reborn and you can continue to practice. If you abandon your spiritual mentors, then even in this life, let alone in future lives, then you've thrown away the opportunity for liberation and enlightenment. Because who's going to teach you? You know? And if we make up our own path, then we get the results of making up our own path. Which we've done numerous times in previous lives, is make up our own path. Okay? So I think it's also good to think about it in that way. You know, think about it in the perspective of many, many lifetimes, of the value of having really excellent spiritual teachers who will guide us over many, many lifetimes, and cultivating those relationships, and then making prayers to be reborn where we can meet them and learn from them.